The most divisive punctuation mark of today. According to Kurt Vonnegut, semicolons represent absolutely nothing except that you have been to college. In other words, they're for show. They're for snobs. Many share this view that the semicolon is pretentious, and many of them probably do not like it because, well, how are you supposed to use it? Cecilia Watson is here to help, not by issuing a set of rules. She is a punctuation theorist who teaches at Bard College, and as an historian, she takes a long view of the maligned semicolon in a book called Semicolon: How a Misunderstood Punctuation Mark Can Improve Your Writing, Enrich Your Reading, and Even Change Your Life. I asked her if semicolons have become irritating because they present themselves as a signifier, a status indicator that you know how to use them properly.
Absolutely, and not just status, but class as well. How much technical grammatical knowledge you have often is a sign of, you know, how much money did your parents pay to send you to private school, for instance. So I think it really does kind of bring up a lot of difficult feelings that people have about those circumstances. And also I found that people would just remember the strangest things. They would remember some particular moment when they were children and an English teacher had embarrassed them in front of the class about how they had used a punctuation mark. And it's really quite remarkable the way that those things travel with people into adulthood.
Are you distressed that, I mean, I'm hazarding a guess that a lot of kids don't learn anything about the semicolon now. Are you distressed about that?
I am distressed about that. And I think certainly the tendency in the United States, and I don't know how it is in New Zealand, but increasingly teachers are tested for students being able to achieve very specific outcomes on standardized tests. And that type of testing to evaluate the quality of teaching invites the quickest, dirtiest, most simplified methods of teaching an art like writing that can be imagined. So a teacher who introduces any kind of ambiguity into conversation, or an instructor who tries to teach students the subtleties of using a mark like the semicolon, is often disincentivized because those students won't test as well as the ones who have been taught much more straightforwardly and use simpler sentences. They get themselves into less trouble.
As you explain in the book, punctuation goes in and out of fashion. Let's talk about the origins of the semicolon. Invented in 15th century Venice. Why?
Well, at that time, writers were in fact wonderfully experimental. So you had a whole bunch of writers from all different countries, but Italy was certainly a central locus because of their publishing industry influence. And writers were sending each other manuscripts and marking them up with both existing punctuation marks and entirely new punctuation marks. And that's how we got the semicolon. One of the publishers working in Italy, Aldus Manutius, thought, you know what, we actually, when we're reading a text, we could use a pause that is a little bit longer than a comma, but shorter than a colon. So he lopped the top dot of the colon off and stuck it over the comma. And there you had the semicolon. And the thing about the semicolon was that once it was introduced in printed text by Manutius, other writers saw it and they thought, you know what, that is useful. So they actually used it and they put it in their own texts. Sometimes people would try to invent a punctuation mark and it would prove not so useful. So you definitely get cases of obscure marks that we no longer even know about, like rhetorical question marks were a thing for a while, and writers just thought, I don't really need one of those. So they died out. But it's marvelous to see that kind of sense of adventure in those texts at the time.
But why do we need the semicolon? I mean, it's not necessary like a full stop or a question mark. It's a superfluity in many ways.
I mean, arguably, even the full stop and the question mark aren't even necessary. I would say that no punctuation is truly necessary. And indeed, written language existed without punctuation quite happily for a while. We could probably get used to that again. But I would say we lose the ability to create rhythm in our texts and to vary rhythm in a way that makes writing sound rich. It creates an experience of reading. It can create meaning within the text. The thing is, though, to be able to see any of those things, we have to avoid thinking of punctuation the way that most of us have been taught all our lives to think of it, which is that it's logical. It's a matter of rules, and where you put a comma versus a colon versus a semicolon strictly has to do with the literal meaning of the sentence. And if you think about the way that maybe grammar books in your childhood were structured, I'm going to take a guess that they all sort of based their conversation around the sentence as a unit. You almost never see them talk about, well, what happens over the course of a paragraph? What if we read a paragraph and we see one really short sentence and then this other long, fluid, flowing sentence? What kind of meaning does that create? What kind of effect does that create? Those aren't questions that logical, rule-based approaches to punctuation are equipped to ask.
One of the famous examples that you talk about in your book is Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, which contains a sentence 318 words long. And he lists injustice after injustice, semicolon together, as you say, holding the prose in suspension, and then the final clause with an M dash. I mean, it's a very theatrical way of presenting it on the page. But does it convert to the voice?
I know what you mean, and this is such an interesting thing to talk to with people about as well, because we all tend to read in different ways. Some of us hear the words in our head as we read. Some people read without any kind of sense of sound in their head. But generally, when I have talked to people about that passage in particular, and this is a passage in which, as you say, King is recounting all of these injustices that he and his children have experienced as people of color in the United States. And he's recounting them in order to argue that the position taken by other pacifists that they should just sit back and wait for change is inadequate. So he heaps them all up, piles them up. And no matter how people read, I have found that once this sentence is kind of called to their attention, they do experience it as a kind of breathlessness. And certainly if you do bother to go ahead and read it aloud, you will absolutely run out of breath. And it creates this sense of absolute exhaustion, of urgency. He never lets you wait in making his point that the cause of civil rights can't wait. And yeah, I think it's probably the most effective semicolon that I can think of in English. If I think of all of the ones I've looked at, that's probably the best use of them that I know.
Let's look at the rules such as they are. The first rule that we're taught about the semicolon is that the part of the sentence following it should stand on its own as a sentence. But this is regularly and fruitfully broken, isn't it, that rule?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And this is the thing about all of the rules and the problem that rule makers had from the very beginning. Any rule that you can make, you can find 100 exceptions for. So what does that mean, really, about the credibility of that rule? At what point can it no longer be said to have the status of a rule? And absolutely, with the semicolon, you are quite right. Writers break that alleged rule constantly. And people who still insist on the rules would argue that what's happening is that they're achieving a certain literary effect specifically by breaking the rules. So you can't understand what's going on in that sentence unless you first know the rule and understand that it's being broken. But that's in itself quite farcical when you consider the fact that grammar rules are incredibly young in the scheme of the English language. They're only about a couple hundred years old. Not even that, in fact, in terms of their popularity. They really get going around 1850. That's sort of when I would say they really pick up and become a thing.
You know, I was really surprised to learn that David Foster Wallace was such a stickler for standard written English.
Yes. You say you were surprised. Do you have some acquaintance with his work that makes that seem a little bit odd to you?
Well, I always imagined that he was a more experimental writer than that. That's how I had him pegged in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, we think of him because he was so genre busting and creative in a lot of ways, where he was writing his fiction or personal essays. You would think that he would have this kind of more freewheeling approach, but not at all. He taught English even after he became well known as a writer. He still taught English, and he insisted very heavy-handedly that students follow conventional rules. And he would frequently teach students who had grown up speaking non-standard English, which in and of itself is, of course, a problematic phrase, but what he called standard written English, he was also willing to call standard white English. And he would admit to students quite openly that is what he was teaching them. That was what he expected them to learn. And he would say, look, I'm doing you a disservice if I pretend that the world doesn't traffic in this specific dialect of English. And it's so extraordinary to me that he got to the point of realizing that he was teaching a specific dialect of English. So he doesn't insist, I am teaching the only English that can exist in the world. I'm teaching the true English. He admits that this is socially constructed, that this is only the true English because a certain elite group of people happen to agree that it is. He gets to that point, and yet he can't make the leap to say, wait a minute, well, if this is just one choice of an English to speak, then I too am making a choice here. It's not just that I should sit in front of my students and say, you have to make a decision to speak this type of English. You can call into question the fact that elite people like yourself who teach at a university are also choosing to subscribe to this as the one type of English that has authority. We could speak any other number of legitimate dialects of English that have their own grammar. So why enforce that kind of status quo?
I'm talking to Cecilia Watson about her book, Semicolon. You describe yourself as a reformed punctuation fetishist. I am a bit of a punctuation fetishist, and I regard it as a character flaw. How did you get over yours?
With great difficulty, and I will be the first to confess that when someone says something that I find disagreeable, either personally or politically, if they make a grammar error, there's a part of my brain that still wants to say, oh, well, sorry, you just split your infinitive, boom, and then act as though I've somehow won. I'm sure a lot of people, common experience, I wouldn't just say in America at this point, probably all over the world, is looking at the tweets of Donald Trump and saying, well, idiot, you've misspelled all of these different words and there are 20 different sentence fragments in here. It makes no sense. But that misses the point for one thing. We end up not addressing the point that we actually want to dispute when we get really exercised about grammar rules. And in other cases, when we just happen to notice errors in, say, a menu at a restaurant you go to that maybe is run by people who didn't grow up speaking English, does it really matter that much? Because generally we still know what people are saying to us if we just try to work it out or if we ask a question. And there's not a lot of good that comes, I think, from hammering on those little differences. So I just try to check myself and think, first of all, this doesn't really matter that much. Let's think about what people are trying to say. And I also think to myself, look, I don't really want to take for granted the fact that I do have this sort of educated background and speak this really privileged form of English and use that to pretend that what I have to say is somehow inherently more valuable than what somebody who doesn't have that background has to say. No, I think
it's very grown up. It's very grown up. such arguments among grammarians, though. I mean, such passion it goes back to the signifier and the status indicator issue, I suspect. And the fashions come and go. I mean, in the 1800s, semicolons became terribly popular and parentheses and colons went out. And then in the early 20th century, once again, the semicolon became fashionable. What's responsible for those fashions?
The million-dollar question. this sort of falls under the tricky category that historians deal with of zeitgeist. You know, what exactly is guiding the spirit of the times? Usually it's hard to find one particular thing. And I have definitely thought about that question with punctuation in particular, and I occasionally do come up with theories that I don't know if they actually hold any water. It's hard to find proof for them, but I think a lot about the M dash, for instance, and why it's the punctuation mark of first resort now. And in some ways it makes some sense to me if I think, well, we're all in a hurry. We all have access to one another through text and through email in a way that is unprecedented. And of course, we need to type out so much so quickly. So naturally, we reach for the one punctuation mark that can just fill in for any other. I don't know if that's all there is to it, though, or not. And certainly it is bizarre when you look back at the semicolon being so popular, and you can kind of explain the other punctuation mark's disappearance by its popularity. It just ends up consuming a lot of other marks. People use it instead of the colon. Places where we would use a colon now, they used a semicolon. Other things, you just think there's some weird aesthetic trend going on. Parentheses, in one of the books I looked at, it calls them a deformity. And it seems pretty clear they do mean something aesthetic, that there's something awful and interruptive about these two curves that are dropped into the middle of a sentence. And that's harder to explain to me. That sensibility is in some ways, just seems to shift with the wind.
There's one thing that you explore, and it's why some people have called the semicolon feminine. You know, it's indecisive, it's girly. Real blokes like Hemingway and Cormac McCarthy don't use the semicolon. Is there any truth in that?
Well, I think there's certainly truth in the bizarre fact that critique of the semicolon so frequently is bundled in with misogyny. I find this so surprising in a lot of ways. The claim is that because it is a mark that can contain some ambiguity. It's not necessarily immediately obvious and fixed what the relationship between one clause and another clause is when you connect them with a semicolon, that supposed wishy-washiness is effete. So some of the words that people have used for it: shy, bashful, gutless, girly, poncy. And in contrast, you get writers saying, look, writing should be butch. It should be manly. And if you want that, then you have to throw out the semicolon. At the same time, other writers have critiqued the semicolon for being kind of too harsh, too hard a stop, too firm a stop. So this is very kind of all mixed up together, the way that people talk about it. I certainly don't think that the semicolon has to be one of those things or the other. It can absolutely convey hesitancy and delicacy, which rightly or wrongly have been associated with stereotypical femininity. It can also be absolutely emphatic and decisive. And there's absolutely no need to think of it one way or the other, much less to think of it as somehow a woman's mark.
It can also facilitate very long sentences like Moby Dick. Herman Melville went on and on and on, thanks to the semicolon, and ended up in a completely different space from where he started out. You have to really pay attention. Do you think that's overuse?
I don't. I think it works so incredibly well in the context of Moby Dick, which is this kind of dreamy sort of prose cloud that is hanging over just the barest of actual plots. Not much actually happens in Moby Dick. Most of it is about this sort of philosophical and aesthetic wandering that happens. I don't know that you could get away with it now. I will say that. One of the things about studying fantastic authors from the past, like Melville, it has a certain utility in terms of figuring out, okay, what can I imagine doing? But if you use semicolons just like Melville did now, you would look pretty retro in a way that might be distracting. So I think the trick is to look at texts like that and let them open up possibilities, but also make sure to kind of read within your own times as well and get a sense of what's modern. But I do absolutely think in that book, it couldn't exist without those unbelievably long sentences and semicolons. That's what makes it beautiful and powerful.
It has become a huge legal issue, as you say. In Massachusetts, there was a semicolon law, and it was about when you could get a drink. I'm not sure whether you can explain this succinctly without actually seeing the semicolon doing the heavy lifting in those two comparable passages of the law. Could you explain it?
That is the trick. And I have to say, one of the funny things to me about my book is that there's an audiobook version, which is apparently quite good. It even won an award. And I'm still uncertain exactly how one conveys in audio a book about punctuation marks. So precisely this problem of not being able to see it comes into play. I'll give an overview, though. There was a case in Massachusetts that started in 1900. A guy went into a bar in kind of outside Boston and wanted to order a drink. And the bartender just didn't particularly want to serve him for whatever reason. And the guy saw other patrons were being served and decided to go ahead and take the bartender to court and sue him for not having given him a drink that night. And the man who filed the lawsuit, his lawyer dug up a copy of the statute governing the hours of drinking establishments in Boston or in Massachusetts at the time. And they said that the law that was on the books said, you can't serve alcohol between the hours of 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. Then there was a semicolon, and it said, nor on the Lord's Day, except if you happen to be an innkeeper. So with that semicolon in there, it looked like except if you happen to be an innkeeper only applied to the Lord's Day. So the idea would be, yes, you can also serve on the Lord's Day as long as you're an innkeeper, but forget serving on any day of the week between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. So the complainant says, hey, this guy was serving other people between these hours. Let's shut him down. And the court agreed. And not only did they agree to shut that establishment, they said, well, obviously, according to the law, nobody can be serving alcohol in Massachusetts between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. That went to appeal, and it was found that the semicolon was actually a transcription error that had snuck in, but the court upheld on appeal because there was precedent to say both that punctuation was a really important part of the law and also that you should completely disregard punctuation entirely from figuring out what the law said. So the court sort of threw up its hands and said, look, this is the most recently repassed version of this law. It's the certified version. We have to go with what's in it. And the semicolon seems to us pretty clear. So people in Boston absolutely went nuts. It's not clear that that many people were really feeling the urge to drink between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. every day. But once they couldn't have alcohol, oh boy, that's all they wanted between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. So you get these just absolutely incredible strategies that people came up with to drink. So they would go to restaurants early and they would just order an entire table full of bottles. And then they would sit and drink all night from those bottles that they had ordered at 4 or 5 p.m. because the law didn't say that you couldn't keep drinking. It said you couldn't be served after 11 p.m. So it became this kind of increasingly, there was a lot of brinksmanship. So somebody would get there at 6 p.m. Then the next week, everybody would get there at 5 p.m. because the previous week, the 6 p.m. people had already ordered all the alcohol that there was to be bought. And while this is all happening, the law keeps getting revisited over and over and over again. People argue over and over about what the semicolon means. It goes to court multiple times. The legislature revisits this matter multiple times. And finally, I think it was 6 or 7 years later, something like that, they finally passed a new statute and took the semicolon out. And of course, all of a sudden, nobody really needed to drink between those hours anyway.
Is there any other punctuation that you would find interesting enough, punctuation mark, that you would find interesting enough to pay such attention to?
I would say all punctuation marks deserve that same level of scrutiny. For me, the reason I chose the semicolon was in some ways coincidental, but in other ways, it is, I think, the mark that people invest the most personal stake in. They have the most uncertainty about it. It's the most symbolic and it's the most confusing to most people. And that makes it an excellent way to examine our anxieties and our assumptions and our errors about language in general. So that for me was really what I wanted to do by looking at punctuation in the first place, was to get into the politics and the ethics of language. So I can't imagine writing another book on a punctuation mark, although I have joked that I could write a book about paragraphs. I don't know that I actually will, but I could.
You've got an example from Henry James, and it's a short one, so I'll mention it. His kiss was like a flash of lightning, semicolon. When it was dark again, she was free. That's from Portrait of a Lady, right?
Yes, it is.
What function do you think in that in that sentence, what function do you think that semicolon serves?
That is the turning point in the life of the protagonist when she is kissed by this man. And then once he lets go of her, she runs off. And it's, in my opinion, an incredibly ambiguous semicolon. It doesn't tell you what goes on in her head, what frees her once that kiss has ended. Unfortunately, though, James revised that passage heavily, as he did pretty much all of his work, and squeezed in all of this other description about what it was that Isabel Archer, the protagonist, is feeling at that moment, what happens in her head. And you're left as a reader feeling almost like you have no role anymore. In that original sentence, the semicolon, I think, invites you to fill in with your imagination what it was she might think and feel based on everything else you've read about her in the book, based on your own life experience. And I love that about that semicolon, that it does strike me as a kind of hand outstretched to the reader. Once you state absolutely everything in an attempt to remove all ambiguity, you remove both the poetry of that and I think the connection between the reader and the book. So I rarely read the revised versions of Henry James and don't just think, oh, what were you doing? It was so perfect before.
And that was Cecilia Watson, author of Semicolon, How a Misunderstood Punctuation Mark Can Improve Your Writing, Enrich Your Reading, and Even Change Your Life.